Okay. My name is Dawn, and I am a grateful, grateful member of Al-Anon. And thank you, Yvonne, for thinking about me and asking me again to talk. I've been in so long that it's interesting listening to people today, and they talked about the fact that we must be retarded. They must be really slow of learning, you know. I claim all those things. I claim all those claims. I came in this meeting when I was 26 years old, and I'll be 90 in a few weeks, a few months. And I'm still coming back. And the reason I still come back is because every day brings a new experience. And each new experience that I experience gives me a new opportunity to use the steps and the traditions and the concepts to work in my life so that I can stay sane and whole. And so I don't think I'm going to ever graduate. I had stopped talking until Yvonne called me a couple of months ago and asked would I talk in a meeting. And I had to hesitate for a minute. And then I said, well, maybe that's why God has left me here this long. I still go to meetings. My home group is the Tuesday Search for Serenity meeting at Martin Temple. Now we're talking on the phone. But I still go to meetings because I remember that this is what has saved my life. Years and years ago, when the program was reasonably young, my husband was serving in Atlanta, Georgia, in the service, and he was sentenced to an AA meeting, and AA was new then. And he went to his first meeting, and they stopped him at the door. And they said, you can't come in. And he said, but I've been sentenced here by my commanding officer. And they said, yes, but this is Georgia. And in Georgia, we believe in separation of races, and you are not allowed in this room. And then one of the old timers in the meeting said, but wait a minute. We can't put him out because the traditions have just passed. And with the traditions, they said that anybody who has a desire to stop drinking is welcome in these rooms. And they said, yes, but the state of Georgia says, and somebody said, well, here's what we'll do. We'll put a chair in the middle of the doorway, and he can sit there, but he can't come in. And so my husband, who was a very sensitive, brilliant young man, realized that this is what his life was going to be. This is what AA had to offer him. But his commanding officer would ask every morning, did you go to that meeting? And he'd say, yes, I went to that meeting. And he didn't tell about the degradation that he faced every time he went and the fact that he had to sit in the doorway. But what he did say was, I listened to those people in that room. And a lot of them were dealing with terrible problems. A lot of them had been out of work. A lot of them were dealing with their own level of pain. A lot of them had lost their homes. A lot of the women were just so disheveled. He said, but they kept coming back and they kept laughing and talking, and he couldn't figure that out. But he knew that he wanted to get in the rooms and they wouldn't let him in. And so when the Korean War broke out, he was sent to Korea. And when he left there, he was so happy he didn't know what to do because he didn't have to sit in that doorway anymore. He didn't have to listen to those people and feel that sense of rejection. He could go on and continue his career in his drinking, in his insanity. And that's what AA was like then. So here we come in 1956, when my husband had been on one of his big, big drunks. And he had left me at home with my babies, and he had forgotten to come home, and it was near Christmas, and the snowflakes were dropping, and I was sitting there alone and afraid and so fearful. I didn't know whether to leave him or whether to stay with him. I didn't know what to do. He had left me at the hospital when I gave birth to our oldest daughter and forgot to come home, and there was another woman in my apartment. And I had stayed anyhow. I had stayed anyhow because my self-esteem was so low. But he called a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And before long, two men came to our door and they took my husband to a meeting. And I remember standing at the door holding the baby. I was so afraid and I kept saying, but who's going to come and get me? Who's going to come and get me? I'm the one here suffering. I've been trying to fix him for this period of time. And you are going to come and get him and help him. But who's going to make it all right for me? And I'd call my preacher and he never showed up. So Peter started that program. And for some reason or other, his life was getting a little better. He was one of those people who thought he only had to work the first step and the 12th step. And he became Mr. AA quickly. And so instead of being home trying to fix our family, he was at meetings all the time. And then I went to one of the meetings where they had the big meeting and people had speakers and so forth. And some lady from Al-Anon got up. And I didn't know anything about Al-Anon. She spoke and she talked about, she was from Texas. Her name was Arlene. I've always meant to ask one of my sponsees, Stephanie, if she ever heard of her. Her husband's name was Buck. But anyway, she spoke and she talked about the disease and what it had done to her life. And I remember thinking, you know, I need to be a part of something like that. So a friend of mine whose husband was also young in the program, she and I went to our first Al-Anon meeting. And it was out at the Hannon Y. And like a lot of the people who are speaking now, are talking about, there was one Black woman in there. Her name was Mrs. Grant. But it was all little white ladies with gray hair. And I looked at them and they were laughing and talking and very friendly to one another. And it was a little calm when I came in. But once they said the Serenity Prayer, everybody said, come on in. You know, it was like the meeting turned on when they said that Serenity Prayer. And I understand that now, because when they said that Serenity Prayer, they invited a higher power into that room. And the higher power was powerful enough to erase all the differences and say, we're here together and we need help. And that's what I heard from those people. They needed help too. They talked about their husbands. They talked about the problems. They talked about the lack of employment. They talked about all the things that I was fearful of. I was worried that we wouldn't be able to send our kids to college and they were still nursing. You know, so I think I was just a little premature. But it was that I heard something that said, I need this. And I don't know, I think that's the miracle of the program. It was not race, it was soul meeting soul. It was pain meeting pain. I listened to what they said and I realized that they had some kind of something that if I kept coming back, maybe I could learn to live with myself and to live with my husband. And so it dawned upon my friend and I, as we were going home, let's start our own meeting. And we will, and Peter's group was mostly Black. And so we decided, this was at East Ferry Group in Detroit, Michigan. And my friend Bernice and I started our Al-Anon group meeting there. You know, that was 62 years ago. Can you imagine that? That was 62 years ago. We started it at the East Ferry Group. The East Ferry Group met at the Northern Recreation Center. Never quite figured that name, but I think it had started at the East Ferry Group. And it was just a wonderful experience. The problem was we didn't have any literature then. We had this little blue book that we would read over and over again, and I would read it diligently, and I would underline all the places that my husband needed help, because I realized that I could fix him and then he was going to love me and worship me for the rest of my life. The other thing they gave me was a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because we had no literature. And so I studied that book and I underlined all the places that my husband needed help. And I became a big book theologian. Now the problem is now, I'm pushing 90 and I've forgotten most of the stuff I learned in that book. But what I did learn was that my husband was sick. I didn't understand that. I thought he did things to get even with me. And I realized he was sick. And I kept going back to those meetings. And I remember I was one of the slowest learner in the meeting. because I couldn't seem to get it, my need to control somebody off him. I was so busy trying to fix him and then to fix my children as they grew that I didn't have the ability to fix myself. And then one time, my youngest child, this time years had passed, we were growing, life was changing. Peter was getting better. His sobriety was periodic. He would have periods of long-term sobriety, and then he'd drop away, and then he'd have another period of long-time sobriety. But he always come back, and he talked like he was a long-timer, and that time he was and he wasn't. He had a lot of knowledge, but he had a lot of fear because he had not dealt in depth with the steps, but neither had I. David was having problems with his life, and we took David to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist turned out to be a cousin of mine, but I didn't know that then. And she said, I want to talk to you and your husband before I talk to David. And so I went in, and I had this kind of sense of self-righteousness because I'm a member of Al-Anon, and I'm trying to fix my husband. So I'm going to go in, and I'm going to really look good in this meeting. I don't know how he's going to look, but I'm looking good. My daughter used to say we're fig trees. We look like we know something, but absolutely nothing is there. So they said to me, she said to him first, on a scale of 1 to 10, what kind of parenting did you receive? And my husband said, I received about a 1 or a 0. And I was just kind of shocked to hear him say that, you know? And she said, now, what kind of parenting did you receive? And I said, well, I received a 9 or a 10. And she got very quiet. And she said, I think we found the problem. And I was smiling because I thought, she's going to say, he received a 0 or 1. I received a 9 or 10. She said, no, you're the problem. And I said, what? She said, no one who has a 10 or a 9 would marry someone who has a 1. I said, what? She said, you need to look at yourself. I thought my problem started when I met the alcoholic. And she said, no. Your problem started way back. You were attracted to the alcoholic. You were attracted to him. Where did this start? And I guess it started in my house. I was born in a parsonage. And I assumed that because I was born in a parsonage, it was a wonderful place. You know, there was no alcohol. There was compulsive eating. We ate like other people drink. But there was no alcoholism. My mother and father were sober, fine Christian people. My father was a pastor of a church that started at 300 and ended up with 6,000. My father was an eloquent preacher. My home was a delight. There was always anything I needed, except I always felt I was on the outside looking in. My grandfather had sexually abused me, and I always felt different. I joined church every Sunday from the time I was 5 or 6 years old. I got on my knees and asked God to clean me up. I just was on the outside looking in. I watched my brothers and sisters grow and go away to college and do the things they were, and I was on the outside looking in. There was always this little voice in me saying, but you're different. There's something wrong with you. I remember one time I learned that I could sing. And when I learned that I could sing, I began to kind of break out of this awful shell I was in. I lived in this, food became my friend, and I lived in this gigantic body. I ate when others drank or did whatever they were doing. I just got grossly overweight so I could hide myself in the shell, and then nobody could really see me. It could be 95 degrees and I would wear a coat to cover up me. I was so ashamed of who I was. And then I discovered I could sing, and I got all the solos in the choir, and I was getting a little self-esteem, and I got involved with some very, very sick men in the church that I was going with. And I ended up being taken advantage of. And I couldn't go home and tell my parents because we don't deal with that stuff. We don't deal with what's going on in life. We don't deal with those things. We just kind of pack those away. You go to church and you have this church feeling and you say everything is all right now and everything is all right. And so we don't deal with that stuff. We just go downstairs and continue to eat and stuff the emotions and feelings. But we don't deal with the reality of the pains and the things that go on in our home. None of us did that. I had a sister who was schizophrenic, but we don't deal with that. We don't deal with that. I had a brother who was trying to be who he wanted to be, which was an actor, but you can't be that if you're in the parsonage. And all these things that were on us that you can't do. But we didn't know what we could do. And for me, I could stuff my feelings. I got pregnant and I had a baby out of wedlock. Carried that baby for 10 months. Called at the hospital and had to call my parents, who had no idea I was pregnant. And they were totally in dismay. And my father said to me, "I don't know what happened, sweetheart." He said, "But do put this behind you." And we got to a stoplight and they took the child out of my arms. And I screamed and I yelled and my life fell even more apart. And then I decided one day, here's what's wrong with me. Nothing's wrong with me on the inside. We got to deal with it. If I look good, if I lose weight, if I become an attractive human being, I'm going to find a husband and I am going to train this husband to love me with all my heart. So I was engaged to a Baptist minister. Then I was engaged to somebody who's working for the government. And then this man came home from the service who had been asked to leave the service because his alcoholism was interfering with his drinking. And he said to me, he said, "You know, Dawn, I'm an alcoholic." And bells went off. "This is somebody I can fix." And he said these words. He said, "I need you." And when he said that, I got a mission in life. That's when I got a mission in life. I remember my dad had a book in his library, and one of the books said, "Man takes the drink and the drink takes the man." Well, for me, it was Dawn takes the man and then the man takes Dawn. And I lose myself again, you know. He also had a book that said, "Your God is too small," by a man named Phillips, I think his name was. And I realized that all my religiosity and stuff, my God was too small. God couldn't contain, the God I had couldn't contain what was on the inside of me. And then we started getting Al-Anon literature. I'm still a big book thumper, but we got Al-Anon literature and we got books and we got literature that we could read on a daily basis. And we started having meetings of people of all color. But I was very blessed that in Detroit, my meeting was mostly Black people. And I was blessed because I didn't have to feel the sense of being different in that room. I just went there because I hurt, you know? I just went there because I was in pain. I went there because my kids were getting in trouble. I just went there because I was falling apart. But then we moved to upstate New York and I was the only Black person. But I had been grounded enough in this program to realize whether they want me or not in this room, I come here because they have some tools in this room and they have some steps in this room. And because of the traditions, they cannot keep me up. And I want recovery. I had hurt long enough. I had all the books now. I had all the things that I could read on a daily basis. But what I didn't have was this true relationship with God that I got through working these steps. When I got through turning my will and my life and my choices, when I got through clearing up the wreckage of the past, when I did that fourth step and I realized that I needed to change, it wasn't Peter. It wasn't about the children. It wasn't about life experiences right then and now. It was that I had to be willing to go back there and clean up yesterday. I had to stop saying, "But you can't do it." You know, there's some things I am not gifted at. I understand that. I'm really, I'm better in a meeting than I am doing certain service works. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the self-centered fear that's still part of me. But I think most of that has been relieved because there was a time in my life when I could not talk in a meeting. then there came a time when my sponsor used to say, you talked enough. You talked enough. But the good news is, when I began looking through those steps and seeing me, and that's why I love to hear the new people. I was so grateful to hear them and to see that as I retire, I mean, I don't know how long Yvonne will be asking me to talk, but when she stops, there'll be the time when I know that this program is fresh, because there will new people will catch the fire. And that's what I caught in these rooms. I got the fire. What I understood through working those steps was God just wanted, it wasn't just turning my will and my life over to the care of God. It wasn't just turning Peter and the children over to the care of God. The things that were blocking me from growing was the character defects. I had become addicted to self-pity and addicted to resentments and addicted to anger and addicted to hopelessness and addicted to despair. I always was waiting for the other shoe to drop, that God wanted to do more to me than just have me leave those substances and those people there. What he really wanted me to do to say, I surrender all. And that's what I had to learn. Now, to do that means that I'm not going to graduate, because life keeps bringing new experiences in my life. And every new experience gives me another opportunity to work these steps. Something will happen and I'll say, is this a 7-step deal today? Or is this a 8-step thing that I have to clear away and make some amends? Something else will happen and I'll say, okay, what is this that's going on today? Is it prayer and meditation? Or is it all of them? Is it all of them? I have a roadmap out of my self-imposed hell that I got in these rooms. And because life keeps bringing different experiences in my life, I have to go back and work them every day. And that's why I don't graduate. That's why 62 years later, I'm still coming here. And whether you think I'm a little bit off as far as a slow learner, that's true. It's okay, because I want to keep learning. I want to keep opening myself up to new experiences. You know, my daughter, my middle child, has mental problems. Brilliant woman, very brilliant woman. She has a degree in theology, a master's in theology. She's pastored many churches. She's taught religion at Berkeley, a very gifted young woman. But you know what she doesn't know how to do? She doesn't know how to look at yesterday and leave it alone. You know? And the reason she doesn't know is because it really is too simple. She's so bright. The reason I can is because I'm not that bright. But I do understand when I'm powerless, you know? 2 years ago, Lisa, my oldest daughter, had an aneurysm. And Lisa's my star. She was a vice president in one of your major corporations. She's the one who's an alcoholic. She had 40 years in sobriety. She announced she was gay. And at first I said, not in my house, because my religiosity got in the way. See, that's the danger of religion. It got in the way. It said Lisa could not be gay and still be a child of God. And Lisa proved to me and showed to me, and her friends showed to me, and people in these rooms showed to me, Lisa was a child of God, one of the finest women I've ever known. And yes, she was gay, and she was proud of that. And I ended up marching in gay parades. And I remember all the Al-Anons were, one of my groups in DC were standing, and they looked over, Dawn, what are you doing in there? I said, my children, I got 3 of them back there, and every one of them has announced they're gay, and I'm celebrating with them. But Lisa had an aneurysm, and I remember flying to Washington to be with her. And I remember saying to God, you know, I had lost a son to AIDS, and I said, God, you can't take another one of my children. Here comes the steps again. And the steps said to me, this is my anchor. This is what I need. The steps said to me, let God be God. Your job is to be faithful to him, to carry the message and say that no matter what, I know I will never be abandoned. And the other thing, that God loves Lisa more than I do. You know, Lisa didn't make it. I used to say, if I lose another child, I'm just not going to be able to go on anymore. And here I am talking. And here I'm telling you this, there's joy in life. And here I'm telling you that there's hope. And one of the things I discovered, this is very interesting to me. Probably haven't talked about this before. Lisa hadn't been going to meetings. 40 years of sobriety, and she's become a real success. You should have seen her staff. They just loved her. And I was out with one of their staff while she was in the hospital, and a woman said to me, Lisa and I had such a great time the other night. We had a cocktail. And I said, no, you didn't have a cocktail. Lisa doesn't drink. And she said, oh, she just had one. And I thought, wait a minute. She hasn't been going to meetings. We're still talking program. When I went to her house, she had ordered a case of wine. Let me tell you how God works sometimes. Lisa was just starting back on the devastating, debilitating journey of alcoholism. And if Lisa hadn't had that aneurysm, and if she hadn't fallen, and if God hadn't called her home, alcoholism would have bloomed again. And that 40 years would have been erased. And that staff that thought she was wonderful would have been looking at her and seeing what an alcoholist is, what alcoholism really is. I believe that God spared Lisa. I don't know that. I mean, life happens and it just happens, but I believe God spared Lisa. I believe Lisa's pain got so bad that she wasn't going to meetings and she just got overwhelmed. And when that aneurysm broke in her brain, he said, I'm taking her. I think sometimes I get some comfort from that, but I don't really know the whole story. All I know is that Lisa didn't have to fall completely. I lost Peter. Lord, it's been 20 years ago. We walked this walk. We spoke at conferences. We had a great time. He finally got sober and stayed sober. He was the joy and the love of my life. You know, I think all those men that I was engaged to, none of them would have been the ones that would lead me to this room, because Peter and I had to go through certain pain and we needed a roadmap. We needed the steps. We needed to learn how to live life and live it on God's terms. We needed to deal with ourselves individually. I don't know how the marriage makes, except for the grace of God. You know, there was one point when Peter was living on this side of the house and I was living on that side of the house. We could hardly stay in the room together. You know, and all at once, because I was able to deal with my food addiction, and I lost 100 pounds, and I stopped eating white flour and sugar, and I started getting sane in my head, we began to talk the same language. He talked sobriety, and I talked abstinence. We talked about hope, and we talked about joy. We laughed about the experiences in our life that had brought us to our knees. We laughed about so many things. We laughed about the experiences where we had lost a home, where we had lost all the things we had worked so hard for and ended up on food stamps. And then all at once, God began to restore to us the years that the locusts have eaten. I love the way God has worked in our lives, you know? And then when Peter got emphysema, he never could stop smoking completely until the last 2 years, but it was too late. And he was in his room and he was dying. And I went in there and it dawned upon me, oh my God, this man is leaving me. We've had almost 50 years and he's leaving me. And I said, honey, you're dying. And he said, I know, Dawn. He said, listen, he said, I'm in here right now. And he said, I'm trying to die. Would you go call your sponsor? She can help you. I can't. And I went in and called my sponsor. My sponsor said, once again, you went to the hardware store looking for bread. I'm so grateful for sponsorship in this room too, in these rooms. I found out that I could stand on my own 2 feet. I never knew that before. These last 20 years have been hard, but they've been blessings. I have watched as I have grown and as the program, I love my meeting, as the program has grown. There's no one in my meeting that I would not recommend to talk at a convention. Those women are growing. Those women are working the steps. Those women are enlightened and growing. And, you know, I sit in those meetings and I am learning. You know, this is the thing why we don't leave this meeting. Anyway, we don't leave any time. I'm mixing up my words to show I'm getting old. Why we don't leave is because there's just so much new to learn. People have learned to look at themselves through a spiritual eye. It's not always what happened, it's what we do with what happens. And that's the thing that makes this program work for me. It was hard back then because we didn't have all the stuff we have now. But here's what we have now. There are no stars in this program, but we value old timers because they tell us where they were and they see where they are now and they know that this program works, you know. And I know that one lady said to me, I was at a meeting and she said, you've been around that long. You must have really been sick. I said, yes, you're right. I really was sick, but I'm well enough to know not to leave. You know, so I don't know where you are in your program. I don't know. You know, when we're new here, sometimes we think our life is different than anybody else's. And we think that our experience is different than anybody else's. We think that whatever we think, we have to get new things to think. I had to give up all that old religiosity that kept me in bondage. I had to give that up. And I had to accept the fact that you're giving me new tools today. And those new tools can take me through any situation. I was, by the way, I meant to tell you, I was reunited with the child that was taken away from me. My life has gone a full service. My son will be 70 years old now. And here I am now having a friendship with a young man who I love dearly. God has restored to me the years the locusts have eaten. And he'll do that for you. I don't care how bad it is, there's a new day ahead. There's a new morning ahead, and there's new hope ahead. And I've worn out of talking. I just want to tell you this. There's a song that I sing, great is God's faithfulness. And that's what I experience, great is his faithfulness. Morning by morning, new mercies I see. All I have needed, God's hand has provided. Great is God's faithfulness to me. If you stay here long enough, you'll experience things and you realize that the only hand that holds you up is your relationship with God. But if you hold on, joy does come in the morning and life is good. Thank you, Ron. I'm tired.